Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Let me start by playing back for you the interview that recorded yesterday with the Premier of Alberta, Danielle Smith. It's a two-parter. First one deals with her thoughts about Prime Minister Brian Mulroney's passing, and then the direction for the province of Alberta. Here's the Premier.
Well, I was very young when he was in office, but he was a figure around our dining room table because my dad always praised him, first and foremost, for ending the National Energy Program, which was so devastating to our province, but also credited him with bringing down inflation and interest rates as well. My parents went through that time where mortgage rates went up to 20%. And so he really felt like Mulroney was the architect of getting us back to some measure of fiscal sanity. I personally got involved in politics around that time. He was still leader, and he was one of the main reasons why I decided to join the campus club for the Progressive Conservatives. And I got a chance to meet him through that at leader's dinner. He and Mila were both working the room, and I was very fortunate to be able to shake hands with him. I had a couple of conversations with him over the years, and I just always found that he seemed to have a lot of time for people and was always ready to give advice. So I think he's going to be very missed. I think he's just been such an incredible figure in Canadian history.
Yeah, very personable and generous man, personally. I had arranged, shall we say, a live one-on-one interview with him when he was prime minister, and he was down to 12% in the polls at that time. And they didn't want to give me the interview, but let's just say I engineered it. You were in radio. You have a good idea of what I'm talking about. So we had a one-on-one interview at L'Hotel in Toronto where the party convention had just ended. And it took me a few minutes. I got into the room. He was there, got up, shook my hand. He was just chatting like we've been friends for 30 years. And it took me a few minutes to realize I wasn't there for a social call. I was there to interrogate him. But he just had this really positive attitude about him. I just personally like the man.
Yeah, I remember he called my producer and she recognized his voice immediately because he did just have quite a distinctive voice. And, you know, that's what I've heard about him is that he was always very kind to people who weren't even at his level of achievement in politics. He was nice and friendly to every person that he met. And I think that probably did him well in history. He may have had a couple of difficult times in those final years. He didn't get the Meech Lake Accord passed, didn't get the Charlottetown Accord passed, had a controversial defense contract that went to Quebec instead of Montreal, or instead of Winnipeg, and ended up as well, I think, with the GST, probably the right decision to make us competitive with the Americans after signing the free trade agreement. But on the balance of things, people, I think, because we weren't able to keep the country united, keep those interests of Alberta and Quebec in sync, even though he dearly tried, I think, unfortunately, that must have been one of those things that he wished he'd been able to solve.
Yeah. Premier, you mentioned that he did away with the National Energy Program, which was delivered by the current Prime Minister's father. What were some of the other major significant initiatives that he undertook that affected Western Canada?
I would say that was probably the most significant. But one of the things I found so interesting about him as a Prime Minister from Quebec is that I think he had an equal interest in the West as well as from Quebec. That doesn't always happen, and it's very rare when you think after him how few conservative politicians have been able to get a toehold in Quebec after the creation of the Bloc Québécois. So I think that's a very unique talent that he had in understanding that Alberta and Quebec's interests are actually very much aligned. The problem was an overbearing central government trying to do too much in areas where it shouldn't and respecting provincial rights. I mean, in many ways, if he had the first approach with the Meech Lake Accord, I think we'd probably have a much happier federation right now. Because I think he really understood that balance a lot better than some of his successors has.
I was talking to somebody earlier in the week, and they were telling me they think the GST was maybe his most positive contribution to Canada. And I can remember sitting in the studio with Michael Wilson, his finance minister, and we were trying to figure out what the GST was. He couldn't tell me. And we were doing the donuts thing. You may remember the story. Do you put the GST on 6 donuts if they're in a package, or does it go on 1 donut if you buy a donut individually? That's the level to which we were reduced, and it turned into a ludicrous discussion. But what GST, what do you think of that?
I'm pretty sure.
I want to raise that topic again.
Albertans would not agree with you on that one. I can tell you one of the lasting legacies was a piece of legislation passed in Alberta saying that there would never be a sales tax unless it was put to a referendum. So I would say that it was incredibly unpopular, probably fueled the rise of the Reform Party. And I don't think that history has been any kinder to it. If you remember as well, Jean Chrétien won an election saying he was going to eliminate the GST, ultimately didn't. And then when Stephen Harper came in, he reduced it by 2 percentage points. So it probably was a smart policy to replace a hidden tax, a manufacturer's tax, with a more transparent tax. But I don't think that there's any love.
Okay. I don't like it. I still don't like it. I understand it now, but I still don't like it. His relationship with American presidents, what are your thoughts?
I must say, coming into politics from the conservative movement, he was one of 3 conservative politicians of major stature at the time. If you look at Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and I think that because that was a really unique time in history to be able to have those 3 political leaders in three of the strongest economy countries in the world able to be in sync on policy. And I think that the fact that we were able to get to a free trade agreement is much to the credit of that relationship. But, you know, he also broke ranks as well with the UK and the US on a really important issue of apartheid and fighting against discrimination and racism in South Africa, for which he's been widely lauded and widely honored. And I think as well, he also advanced issues on the environment. Environment was very important to him, participating in UN conferences, but also addressing issues of sulfur dioxide emissions that were causing acid rain. So I think that he was able to advance conservative policies, but also be able to distinguish himself from his much larger neighbors in some really important policy areas.
Let me move on to the initiatives that you're undertaking in Alberta. And you're limiting introduction of renewables, which will be built on farmlands and creating buffers for pristine landscapes. Your critics are worried. They always go to the critics, right? You're worried. They're worried that you'll limit or stop private investment in renewables in the province. Can you talk to us about that, please?
Well, it's not the case. I mean, when you look at what's happened in Ontario, they had a 7-year moratorium on wind and solar. I think they've just announced a call for 5,000 megawatts to come in on a power purchase agreement. Manitoba just announced they wouldn't be allowing any independent renewable development. And I must say we are the destination for private investment because we're the only province that allows it because we don't have a crown corporation that controls our power grid. So I think people need to look at it from that perspective and also understand that we just had a threat of a power outage in the middle of January because at 5 o'clock at night, when it was minus 35, there was no wind blowing and no sun shining. And as a result, we had to rely 100% on our interties with our neighbors and natural gas. So when I look at wind and solar, I say, great, it can be a portion of our power grid. But I also need to make sure we bring on a responsible amount of wind and solar that has backup. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is that we've made mistakes in this province in not having enough clarity about who would pay when projects come to the end of their natural life. And there's a big reclamation cost. So we want to make sure that that is staged over time so that money is there, so landowners aren't left holding the bag. And we also know that we've seen around the world that there's litigation against government for allowing renewable projects to take up prime agricultural land. So we don't want to find ourselves in those same positions. And so those are some of the guardrails that we've put in place. And I think we're going to continue to be the destination of choice for wind and solar.
And a $200 electric vehicle tax introduced in your budget. That's gotten a lot of attention, maybe disproportionately, but talk to us about that, please.
Well, Saskatchewan does the same thing. And I think probably for the same calculation that we've done is that if we're going to see an increasing amount of zero emission vehicles on the road, they have to pay their fair share of what it costs to keep our roads maintained, especially since they're heavier. And so they would have exactly the same or greater impact. So we did a calculation of what the typical fuel tax would be for a typical vehicle that's using combustion engine vehicle. And that's what we've set the fee at. And so as the number of zero emission vehicles rises, that will have them paying their portion of the road's costs. I think it's a pretty modest fee, quite frankly, and it makes sense for us to make sure that we have that parity now, just as the investment and purchases of those alternative vehicles are beginning to grow.
On the PharmaCare issue, you agree that Mr. Trudeau desperately jumped on Jagmeet Singh's final offer to continue their coalition agreement by signing on to PharmaCare. The Liberals, I don't think, wanted a national PharmaCare program at this time, and you have said Alberta will not participate. Can you fill us in, please?
Well, it's not a national universal PharmaCare program. It's a two-drug plan. And I have to tell you, we've got seniors on our PharmaCare plan. We've got those who are disabled. We've got people on AISH. We've got our entire public service. And if I went to them and said, hey, we're going to cancel your plan, and we're only going to cover birth control and diabetes medication, do you think that's a fair deal? You'd say you better believe not. I mean, this is the real problem, is they're portraying it as something that it's not. A true national single-payer PharmaCare program would cost $40 billion. And there is no point in doing something half-measured. If they want to come and assist us in expanding our current PharmaCare program, which covers 5,000 different medications, so that more people are covered and we can make sure that everyone does have insurance, then let's have that conversation. But don't try to pretend to me that a two-drug plan is anything remotely close to what we're already offering in Alberta. It's insulting.
You're calling, you're asking for Mr. Trudeau to call an election. What are you getting back?
Well, look, part of the reason for that is he flew into our province. One of his staff texted my chief of staff hours before. And then he does an announcement, slams my government, and then flies out again. And the way I look at it is that is not cooperative federalism. That is not an appropriate way to be engaging with the provincial government in their area of jurisdiction. He did the housing announcement without inviting my housing minister, without coordinating with us, without even telling us what was going on. And so it seems to me the only reason he staged that was so that he could criticize our province. And if that's what he's going to do, use us as a punching bag to try to win votes in the rest of the country, then, and if he's already in the middle of campaigning, then he should just call a campaign and get it over with, so that we know either we'll be dealing with him for the next 4 years, or we'll be dealing with the official opposition leader for the next 4 years. But trying to fight a proxy war with Alberta is not helpful when we have a lot of things that we need to solve. It's not very professional. And so that's what I'm saying. Either come to the table, work with us in a spirit of collaboration, or call an election.
Premier, let me, in a minute we have left, come back to your budget. And you're expecting a budget surplus this year. Not a huge budget surplus, but you're expecting a surplus.
One of the things that I've begun to see is that we've been increasing spending at the rate of inflation and population growth. And the problem is that our revenues are not growing at the rate of inflation and population growth. So if we keep on doing this, it means that we're either setting ourselves up for borrowing and deficits or over-reliance on our resource revenues, which I would say we have right now. So I had to send the signal that we've got to do things differently in Alberta. We've got to start slowing the rate of increases. We have to keep increasing because we're having people continue to move to our province. We still need to build schools and hospitals. We still need to hire nurses and doctors. But we can't keep growing at a rate of 6 or 7 or 8% per year. It's just not sustainable. So I'm asking Albertans to work with us to be more restrained and find better ways of delivering the services, but also so that we can put some money into the Heritage Savings Trust Fund and start growing that so that it's a true sovereign wealth fund. If we just kept the investment and commitment to the fund, it would grow to about $125 billion by 2050. If we added $2 billion per year, it could grow as high as $400 billion by 2050. And then some future government will have a secure supply of investment income to replace our reliance on resource revenues. So that's the vision I've put out for our people in Alberta to work with us to strive towards so that we can create that alternative revenue stream. It takes a little bit of time to get there, but we've got to hunker down and be a lot more restrained over a long period of time in order to be able to achieve that target. And we'll see how this year goes. I'm very worried about the volatility in oil and gas prices, very worried about the potential, if it goes too low, of putting us in a deficit position again. So we've got to take some measures now to make sure that doesn't happen.
If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.